Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 15th of July 2018. My name is TRP Watson and this time I'm joined by Gareth James.
We're now going to talk about the Lehman Trilogy at the National Theatre. This is a production adapted by Ben Power of Stefano Massini's play, first written in 2013, with a major production in 2015 in Italy, and then productions all over the world. It is, in its raw form, a staggeringly long play, I think over 5 hours, if not getting towards 10. We are treated in this production to just 3 hours and 20 minutes. It is directed here by Sam Mendes, with a design by Ez Devlin. The play tells the story of the Lehman Brothers investment bank, which collapsed spectacularly in 2009, but had built up a massive reputation from its founding, which happened in the 1850s as a bank, but they were really cotton factors before that, and at first it was a small general merchants in Montgomery, Alabama, where a young immigrant who arrived in 1844 called Heim Lehman had to set up this little shop, and he brought in his two brothers, and everything builds from there. They become one of the most successful brokerages and investment banks on Wall Street, and finally they collapse. It takes in this story of this family that starts with these three brothers using just three actors. We have Adam Godley, Ben Miles and Simon Russell Beale. They play multiple generations of the family and they also play other characters that get involved. The setting is a rotating box which looks like a modern day office in an office block, with piles of legal boxes that people use when they're clearing out their desks. And of course the play starts with this idea of the Lehman Brothers collapsing and all the people ready to clear out their desks. We then move back in time, but still in this office environment, and the Lehman Brothers turn up dressed in appropriate fashions for the 1840s, perhaps, or a little bit later, and they continue wearing that. They simply tell the story through, well, acting. Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Well, it wasn't until I'd left the theatre that I learned that, you know, in other productions it was up to 5 hours long and had huge casts. And I have to say, when I went in, because I tend not to read much about something before I go, and certainly don't read reviews if I can avoid it, I was expecting something with a lot of people, with a big cast, something sort of quite epic. So I was quite surprised, because I only realised it was three actors when I went in. So I was quite surprised at that approach, really. And what Ben Power has done in adapting it is he's taken it to under 3 hours playing time. And what Sam Mendes has done, of course, is chosen to use just these three actors to tell this story, which actually does span 175 years. Although we don't get much from the period after the last Lehman brother dies, which is 1969. And I just thought it was just an inspired idea, really. And it just becomes pure storytelling and brilliant acting. And it's not just the story of this dynasty, it's really the story of capitalism, it's the history of capitalism. And it's also, you know, about immigration to the USA, which was somewhat ironic, as I saw it on the day Trump was holding forth here. The three brothers were sons of a German-Jewish cattle merchant from Bavaria, and they arrived within 6 years of each other, between 1844 and 1850, Henry being the first, and then Emmanuel and Mayer following. Those were their chosen American names, not their original names. And they start, as you said, in a general store in Montgomery, Alabama, before they become cotton traders. And it's only after Henry dies that they move to New York City, and that's the point at which they expand into coffee trading and into investing in railways. They do apparently invest in the Panama Canal, which kind of took my breath away, I have to say. And then eventually, you know, everything from airlines, cigarettes, films, armaments, and of course banking. Banking does actually start in 1867. But the thing that killed them, the sort of investment trading that killed Lehman Brothers after the last Lehman had gone, actually they didn't get into until 1965, some 121 years after the original business was actually formed. It's a fascinating story. What's fascinating is that, you know, they survived so many things. You know, they survived financial crises in 1857, 1873, and of course the big one in 1929. You know, they lived through the American Civil War, two World Wars. They were in the World Trade Center when 9/11 happened. And of course, the business ended up being killed off in 2008 by the successors to the Lehman Brothers, who'd long gone, even though the business still had their name. And it was only six brothers from three different generations that had led this business over that 125 years, because two of them had actually led it for 60 years each, or two of them had been in it for 60 years each. I think that the idea of the three actors remaining in the clothes in which they arrive and then playing multiple roles is an inspired idea. These roles are of all ages and generations and sexes, because that actually kind of lightens and provides some necessary humour to the story. And another brilliant idea is to have live piano at the side of the stage, which is superbly played by Candida Caldicott. And you know, it's almost as incidental music, and not just, you know, occasionally. It's you're conscious of it a lot of the time. Es Devlin, as you say, has sort of created this glass-walled office representing effectively where the company meets its demise in 2008. And we do start there and flash back. But the whole play takes place within that office, with a giant screen behind it, on which Luke Hoare projects other locations, you know, the skyline of New York City or the cotton fields of Alabama burning. And they really only used the sort of box files from packing up in 2008 to create things like shop counters and steps. And the whole thing is monochrome. And there's no colour in the whole piece. It's all in monochrome. So it's got an incredible simplicity about it, which I found, you know, was enthralling storytelling, really. And the whole 3 hours and 20 minutes just flew by for me. It didn't lose me for one moment. And I was, you know, I left the theatre feeling as if I'd eaten a terrific meal and was absolutely satisfied. What did you think, Tim?
It was, I think, very satisfying and fascinating insight into, you know, this growth of American capitalism. There have been one or two people who pointed out some problems, particularly really not thinking about or dealing with slavery properly, which is a bit of a problem. But one of the things I think works quite well in this is actually just having the three people telling the story. I think it would have actually, oddly enough, got rather confusing if you'd had a very large cast and people you liked kind of disappeared, because you would have, not to give too much away, you would have got rid of Simon Russell Beale's first character in the first half an hour of the play or something. So it's quite good that you keep those people on and they just take on different characters and they firmly characterise those people. One of the slight problems I had with it, oddly enough, watching it, is just thinking it's a pity they didn't get an actress in to play, or more than one, because although Adam Godley and Sam Russell Beale and Ben Miles are excellent in this, and they are, you know, they are enthralling, you couldn't help thinking, well, there's an actress of about the same age as them, there are probably dozens of them who could have done a good job and, you know, maybe just mixed it up a little bit. It does feel a little bit masculine. But then I suppose when you talk about the world of high finance, you are often talking about that kind of masculinity which can turn toxic, that kind of environment, which is often seen as a very male environment, especially in trading. You get that impression, you know, when you're selling, it does feel to be something that has traditionally been a very male thing and a very male-orientated idea. So perhaps that's what they're looking for here. But I did think it a little bit of a pity that I could name half a dozen actresses easily who could have been slotted in, but I'm not sure which one of the actors I would have wanted to lose, because they were all very good. So, you know, it's just a thought overall. It is telling a fascinating story and, you know, not necessarily sympathetic. I don't think it goes into an awful lot of detail about how things work. I mean, it's not like we're watching sort of a movie explaining how, you know, the financial crash happened. We don't really get a good picture of that. It is mostly about the people. We don't really get the idea of how one of the brothers, I think he's a grandson of the originals, how he manages to rescue Lehman Brothers after the Wall Street crash in 1929. We don't get really get that picture, but we do get the struggles of him as a person emotionally. There's no detail. If you happen to be somebody interested in that, you're not going to get that. You're just going to get this very personal story of these characters, of these Lehmans, because there are lots of Lehmans about, and even now there are lots of Lehmans about, but they've gone into other things and they've taken the wealth of the original three brothers and it has been spread out. So you do have a rich family. I mean, there is a whole branch of the Lehman family who went into politics and they are even now attorneys general and governors and things like that still around. I think there are a couple who are even now congressmen of some description. So it does get you interested in the family and does get you interested in looking into them, but we don't get the financial nitty-gritty, which perhaps you would have seen in a film like The Big Short, for example, where you get the detail. Actually, that's something I would quite have liked to have seen, but that's not what this play is about. It's about, really, the family. So I thought it was extremely well done, but a few very, very minor reservations, just a way of saying, well, that's not quite how I would have done it, rather than saying that they were wrong to do what they did, because I think it works extremely well. It is a long night, but it did work extremely well.
I'm not sure. I mean, it's not trying to tell us about the 2008 crash. I think Enron did that perfectly well. I think that's not the point of the story. I think that it's trying to do something very different to that, which is to link together the personal story, the story of capitalism, and I think about immigration to America as well. I think that's, you know, we forget that this nation has been built on people like the Lehman Brothers and many others like them. And I don't think, you know, even though, yes, obviously they don't really explicitly refer to slavery, you know, it can't do all of that. It's 175 years of history in 3 hours, you know, and it can't take all of that in, really. So one of my companions sort of said they would have preferred to have had more about the crash and about that sort of latter period, if you like. But then again, it's about the Lehman Brothers, and their history ends in 1979, really, because that's when the last Lehman is in the business. And as you say, there are other Lehmans still around, and Herbert Lehman in the play does go into politics, one of the brothers in the play, quite soon after he's got into the business. But I don't think that's what the play is trying to do. I think the play is trying to do something else. And in that sense, I think it's refreshingly different to anything else that has been attempted on stage with any similar ideas. Right?
We're now going to talk about Imperium at the Gielgud Theatre. This is the RSC's production of Mike Poulton's adaptation of a trilogy of novels by Robert Harris. But it has come in from the RSC, where it played at the Swan to great acclaim. It's directed here by Gregory Duran, with a design by Anthony Ward. It tells the story of Cicero, played here by Richard McCabe, seen through the eyes of his secretary, who starts as a slave and becomes a free man, Tyro, played by Nicholas Kolosker. And it really looks at Cicero's life. The books, as far as I remember, deal with basically three big parts of Cicero's life, and I think that the first book is dealt with in the first 20 minutes of the first play, which is called Conspirator. The first book leads up to the first great trial that Cicero tries, where he catches out a governor of Sicily who tortured to death a man who kept repeating that he was a Roman citizen and basically had therefore done it illegally, and that's why the case is won, essentially. Then I assume this play, which is split into two parts, first of all Conspirator, then Dictator, then deals with the main meat of the other books, which takes us through what are known as the Catiline conspiracies, where a man called Catiline is a general, and he basically tries to take Rome over, and Cicero defends Rome from this man, really through a force of will, and keeping the Senate together, and also keeping two very particular people who are kind of friends of Catiline, but are also ambitious on their own account, Pompey and Julius Caesar. He tries to keep them sort of at arm's reach. He keeps kind of on friendly terms with them, but knows that they want exactly what Catiline wants. They want to be the great dictators of Rome. And slowly dealing first with Pompey, who becomes effectively Rome's greatest general and almost its dictator, almost its sole ruler. But it is then Julius Caesar who takes over and successfully does that and successfully becomes the richest man and able to control the Roman Senate and the Roman people. The most important thing is the idea of being the consul. In Rome, there were two consuls every year. They were elected and they shared power. The problem was, of course, that the parties, the factions in the Senate would try to get their people into the consulship and hopefully you get a strong person and would hope for their strong candidate against a much weaker person who couldn't quite keep up. Therefore, you'd have one person in charge. It kept on for years and years and years, and you used to get ridiculous things in the time of Caligula, where he allegedly made his horse into Tartus, a consul. And we are moving into the imperial days. We see not only Catiline, who is played here by Joe Dixon, and Joe Dixon plays a number of other parts as well. We also have Julius Caesar played throughout by Peter de Jersey. We then slowly move on to one of the most interesting people, I think, in Imperial Rome is this character of Octavian, who becomes much more important after Caesar is assassinated. And Octavian is this little kid with his best friend Agrippa, and you see them rising up and being able to put themselves into a position where Augustus becomes this massively successful person and this massively successful leader. And from being, you know, just a little boy, I mean, he's 18, I think. And by the time he wins, he is in his early 20s. He's very young when he becomes the ruler of the Roman world, which was a massive area at the time. We do see that build up all the time. We have this constant character. We're seeing it really through the eyes of Cicero and through Tiro. Tiro's having to be there. He is talking to the audience and communicating with them. For somebody who is a bit of a history nerd, somebody who likes his Roman history, likes his I Claudius, and has been fascinated by this sort of thing and always wants to see, you know, whenever you do Julius Caesar and Antony and Cleopatra, that idea of the young boy coming in to take over, this Octavian coming in to take over, it deals with it really rather well. I mean, Cicero has a walk-on part in Julius Caesar. It is the famous line, he said something in Greek. It probably was very important, but it was all Greek to me, or words to that effect. But we get the phrase, it's all Greek to me, which is said about Cicero in Julius Caesar. So he's this sort of important background character. We also have another interesting character in there, which is Cato, who is this rather unpleasant man who wore very few clothes and never washed. He's a force of republicanism, much more than Cicero is. Cicero is a lot about the law, but he also likes the dignity of the Senate. Cato is much more about the people and the Rome and things like that. So as somebody who knows a little bit about this and has done read quite a lot about Roman history of this period, it is fascinating. And Mike Alton manages to capture, it feels that he manages to capture the books very effectively. I have to admit, I've not read the last two books, I think, but he does seem to catch the tone and the struggles in it. It isn't over glamorized. This story was also told in the television series Rome, which of course was a little bit more sexed up, and really, and although it did deal with important characters like this, that was really told from the point of view of a couple of soldiers. Robert Harris's Cicero as this person who takes us from Republican Rome through to Imperial Rome and crafted a good story. And I think the RSC have really done well to put this on and create it. I have to say, I heard extremely good things about it when it was in Stratford, it was done at the Swan, and it seemed to have a lot of fascination, a lot of energy. I have to say, I didn't quite feel that energy here. It's something that perhaps it is the layout and the lack of intimacy in the Gielgud, or relative lack of intimacy in the Gielgud, that it loses something. The same applied last year when we got The Much Ado About Nothing paired with Love's Labour's Lost, that the RSC did to great acclaim, and that after a couple of years that came in from Stratford into the Theatre Royal Haymarket, and again it didn't quite have the energy, it didn't quite have the fascination that the plays had garnered when they were up in Stratford. Maybe it is something to do with London being just a little bit extra if they can negotiate it, and it's not really seen as important anymore to the RSC. There's this feeling of it losing energy. It's not that the performances felt bad, it's just that the audience just didn't seem enthused a lot of the time. And in fact, when I saw the second part of this play, Dictator, I bought a pretty cheap ticket, but I was put into the stalls, and the stalls were maybe half empty. So I don't think it's garnered much enthusiasm, and that kind of works on you when you're watching it, because although you're watching some very good performances and some really nice work and a nice piece of historical storytelling, you couldn't help but think, well, I don't think people around me are enjoying it as much as I am, and that does kind of get to you after a while. What did you think about this, Gareth?
I think there's a bit of a phenomenon at the moment. The big hits that have come into London are not doing good business in London. And it's not just these two plays, it's also Consent from The National and The Jungle from The Young Vic. None of them are actually doing the sort of business they deserve and the business they had when they started out, well, not outside town, but when they started out in the subsidised sector. I think it's a combination of it's summer, and it's a hot summer so far, and then you've got sporting events like the World Cup, and I think also, frankly, the pricing as well. I saw this in Stratford and didn't have to pay as much to see it in Stratford as you probably have to pay to see it in the West End in terms of top price tickets. So I'm talking about this from the perspective of seeing it at the Swan 7 months ago. And I also think that the Swan is a particularly good space for this kind of epic, because before now, they've done two that have also transferred the West End, two-parters, Canterbury Tales and Wolf Hall, / Bring Up the Bodies, and both of those were, of course, also adapted by Mike Poulton and directed by Greg Doran and originated in the Swan and came into London. And I think the Swan is a particularly good space for this because it has a combination of an intimacy but also a sort of space that allows the epic to be epic. So, for example, in this particular case, the sort of triumphal scenes were absolutely fantastic in the Swan, because you've got the sort of the brass sound, you know, it's quite loud in a smaller space, and people marching down the staircase that was at the back of the Swan apron stage. Cicero, as you say, is a small character in Julius Caesar, and Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. In fact, he gets 9 lines. And the reason you can now give him 6 hours of playing time is because his, well, slave-turned-confidant and biographer, Tiro, did record all of this. And they were known to Plutarch, who was also the source of Shakespeare's play. So Robert Harris's books, and therefore Mike Poulton's adaptation, seem to me have a solid foundation in fact, because they're based on those. And it is a fascinating story. I mean, this man, you know, I called him the most significant Roman you don't know anything about. And that's, I think, because he was an orator and a lawyer rather than an emperor or a military figure. You know, we've had work about the Caesars, if you like, but not really about people in the background. And he's a man in the background. And I think was considered to be the father of the Republic, and also was the man that people went to for legal advice and indeed for rhetorical coaching. He was known for coaching in rhetoric, and in later in his life became a philosopher. And when the play starts, you know, Rome is a republic, or when the first play starts, so there's a sort of democracy. You know, two consuls are elected annually by a senate, which is made up of the great and the good of Rome. Most of them, of course, are rich patricians, so it's not a true democracy. But you do have some self-made plebeians, like Cicero himself, in fact. And he's a consul and therefore a protector of the republic. But when Julius Caesar comes back in his triumph, he turns the republic into a dictatorship, and that's when Cicero first goes into exile. But before Caesar is assassinated, he's back again, although he doesn't play a part in the assassination. But he comes back thinking, well, we're going to be a republic again. But sadly, Mark Antony, who's, I think, very influenced by his wife, Fluvia, and indeed in this version, it's suggested that he's pretty permanently drunk. He continues to have a life of excess and corruption, and indeed a continuation of dictatorship. And I think at that point, it does take this interesting turn, because Octavian, who's very young, approaches Cicero with a view to getting advice and help. And indeed, Cicero does provide that. And he kind of, I think, does that in the hope that maybe Octavian, when he becomes Caesar, could actually go back to the Republic again. But sadly, Octavian continues to be the next dictator, Augustus. And I think this is a final disappointment, I guess, for Cicero, really. I mean, I think it's a brilliant adaptation, although I haven't read the books. But, you know, Mike Poulton's adaptations are just remarkable because, you know, he manages to get a story that's rich in narrative. It's got a real kind of theatrical, dramatic potential. I thought this one was a slow burn at first. I thought the first couple of parts of the first play were just a bit slower. But by the time you get about half to two-thirds into the first play, you're absolutely gripped, or I certainly was absolutely gripped. Now, I did have to say, see them in one day. I saw them in the afternoon and evening. So by the time I got in for the second play, I couldn't wait, really. I was very excited and very much looking forward to the next part. I thought they were very well staged by Greg Doran, and I liked Anthony Ward's very simple design. The idea of the stairs at the back, certainly in the Swan, and a pit below, and A Giant Globe Above provided a kind of very flexible but also very evocative sort of setting. And there's really good music from Paul Inglishby, heavy on brass for the triumphal scenes. And I thought that added a lot to the production as well, really. This has got to be a career high for Richard McCabe. You know, he's on stage an awful lot of the time, and I thought he was absolutely brilliant playing this part. And I also thought Joseph Kloska, who's, you know, quite a sort of a small man in a sense, makes this journey from slave to assistant to confidant to advisor to biographer. And I thought he was outstanding as well. Peter Jersey, I thought, made a great presence as Julius Caesar. Joe Dixon, also as Mark Antony, a sort of, you know, power-hungry chancellor, as it were. And then Oliver Johnson, who, you know, plays this seemingly unambitious Tavio and then becomes probably the greatest despot of the three, really. And then we've got about 17 other people playing the remaining of the roles. So I was, even though when I went to Stratford, it was difficult because it was a snow weekend, I was really glad I went to Stratford to see it. I thought it was a fantastic achievement. You know, it's the sort of theatre that you remember for years to come. And the RSC had done a lot of it. In addition to the two we mentioned, you know, we go back to Nicholas Nickleby. They've done a lot of this kind of immersive theatre. And I must admit, I'm someone who really likes to immerse themselves and to do things in whole days or afternoons and evenings. So on the basis of what I saw in Stratford, I've been strongly recommending people to see it in London, and I see no reason why I shouldn't continue to recommend it. It may not be quite as good, but I'm sure based on what you're saying, it's worthwhile.
I'm now going to talk about For King and Country at the Southwark Playhouse. This is a 1964 play written by John Wilson, based on a 1955 novel, Return to the Wood, by James Lansdale Hodgson. This play usually goes under the name of Hamp, but it was made in 1964 into a movie by Joseph Losey, which starred Dirk Bogarde and Tom Courtney under the name of For King and Country, and that's what the play often gets played as these days. It is directed here by Paul Tomlinson, with a design by Jacqueline Gunn. We are on the Western Front, in the British sector, in 1918. Private Hamp, who volunteered in 1914, has been in and around the front for 4 years. He has recently survived a rather unpleasant time in No Man's Land, where he almost drowned. And he decides he's had enough and walks away and almost gets back to the coast and back to visit his family. His girlfriend has recently deserted him, and yeah, he just doesn't seem to want to fight anymore. The military police have picked him up and he is being court-martialed. We meet him in his cell. He is appointed a defence counsel, Lieutenant Hargreaves, who tries to understand what Private Hamp has done. Private Hamp is a very simple man who basically says, "I came to the end of my nerve." That's pretty much it. He doesn't really elaborate on that. He's somewhat simple-minded, but not, you know, not so much stupid as unimaginative. Somebody who doesn't really think hard about anything. He gets a very bad time from his platoon commander, Lieutenant Webb, and a lot of support from a padre who's trying to help him under court-martial, because Lieutenant Hargreaves has been trying to understand Hamp's motives. It begins to sound like Hargreaves has been coaching him in trying to explain what Hamp has done. Hamp takes on some of those explanations and repeats them back. It seems very clear in the court-martial that perhaps Hargreaves has been coaching him and trying to push a certain point of view on things. Hamp did go to the medical officer, but the MO just thought he was malingering and gave him a dose of laxatives to buck him up. This production stars Adam Lawrence as Private Hamp, Lloyd Everett as Lieutenant Hargreaves, Henry Prophet as Lieutenant Webb, Eugene Simon as the Padre, and Andrew Callum as the medical officer, with Fergal Coughlan, Peter Ellis, Cameron Robertson, Nick Salmon, and Thomas Weir. This play hasn't been performed in London since 1964. There was a production of this in 2009, which looked rather promising, in the Belgrade Theatre in Coventry, but didn't come in. Written in 1964, this is very much the time when the historical consensus was essentially lions led by donkeys, the idea that the ordinary soldiers were brave as anything and they were commanded by donkeys. This is actually something that the historian and MP Alan Clark came up with and later backtracked a little bit on. And in fact, modern historians mostly say that the officer class weren't all that bad, weren't quite donkeys, but they didn't always do the sensible or the right thing. But this play is very much of its time and with this attitude that certainly the top brass are more interested in making an example of somebody, and that they regard really that all soldiers are essentially cowards. This is something that you see time and time again when you talk about, certainly in the First World War, you have examples like the Royal Flying Corps aren't allowed parachutes because, well, they're going to use them. They're not brave enough to stay in their planes. There's also lots of things where the officer class expect the ordinary soldier to be malingering, to not want to fight, to be basically being cowards. And this is something that feels fairly typical within the First World War. They just didn't trust them. And it went on, I mean, in the 1930s, when they were preparing for possible bombing of London, they expected massive deaths, mass riots, all sorts of horrible things happening. And in fact, they didn't. You know, there is a lot of stoicism in the ordinary soldier and in the ordinary people of Britain that was not expected by the ruling class. So this play really deals with that, but also deals with this very real possibility of Private Hamp being shell-shocked and simply not being able to cope anymore. I was slightly reminded of when I read Spike Milligan's biography, his war diaries, the book called Mussolini, His Part in My Downfall. It ends when Spike Milligan gets mortared while he's trying to run a line up to the OP. He was part of the heavy artillery. He gets very badly shaken up, very, very badly shell-shocked. He's simply incoherent. He's usually reliant on his diaries, but he simply can't remember what happens next. He has to build the picture up from various people. He only has fragmentary ideas of it. But once he's sort of clear of that and he's brought into a sort of a situation where, although he's slightly anaesthetized and possibly on some kind of drugs to suppress his mood, he gets put back into a place where there are a lot of other shell-shocked people, a lot of other people with what we would call PTSD now, and he simply can't understand why he ever wanted to fight the war, why gentle people like him would ever be interested in it. And I got a lot of echoes from that in this play, with Private Hamp especially. You know, this is a man who, he's been there for 4 years, he hasn't got a friend in the world, they're all dead, or they're all out of the picture, and he's just come to the end. He can't cope anymore. Now, these days, in the army certainly, they're very aware of PTSD, they're very aware of battle fatigue and shell shock, and they completely understand it, and would never ever think of putting somebody on court-martial for just being not able to cope anymore. They do investigate it, but if somebody clearly is unable to cope, they wouldn't push it anymore. It is very clear here that in the court-martial, not giving too much away, they do suggest mercy, but the higher ranks have a different idea. Once again, not trusting the ordinary soldiers, they need to set an example. Which, of course, reminds you slightly of the film Paths of Glory, Stanley Kubrick film, which is much more brutal in the way that they set an example in that film, but they have to set an example in For King and Country, and Private Hamp, unfortunately, is that example. This is a really fascinating play. I thought the production, its grasp didn't quite meet its reach. It didn't quite get there. It was a nice, solid, well-done production, very well acted, I thought, especially by Henry Prophet and Adam Lawrence and Lloyd Everett. But somehow it needed to feel bigger. I think that one of the things about this production, it didn't get enough attention from mainstream media. Usually plays at the Southwark Playhouse get a bit more attention. I think it just got lost in the mix with a lot of the national reviewers, so didn't really get the attention it deserved. And I wasn't really a particularly full house when I went, so it was a bit of a pity, because it was a very, as I say, very solid production and really decently acted. I couldn't help noticing when I looked back in the records, the production of the Belgrade and Coventry in 2009 was much starrier, and I think if they'd been able to throw some really starry actors at this play and given a production that met those starry actors' abilities, then this play would have been quite a hit. As it is, it was a really decent play, and it's, you know, made you want to see the play again and to see it done more often. It's the first time for 30 years. This play should be, you know, on every Well, I know, somewhere between 5 and 10 years, it certainly deserves that kind of outing and that kind of investigation. So a solid production, but not a great production, I thought, and no reflection on the actors. It just wasn't quite magnificent.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the As Yet Unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.